myself out.
I am afraid of...
I'm terrified and paralyzed by...
I am deathly afraid of...
Welcome to the Sum of All Fears podcast with your host, me, Ryan Perio. Hello and welcome to the Sum of All Fears podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Perio. This week, my guest is comedian Billy McFarland. Billy is a comedian here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He's also done some road gigs out in Oklahoma, Arkansas, as well as other states. Billy is one of my favorite people to talk to. He's super funny, and we sat down for this episode. In this episode, we talk about him playing college basketball, how he got into stand-up, becoming a general manager of a comedy club here in Dallas-Fort Worth, and then we get into his fear of confrontation with a bunch of stories of Billy getting into and not necessarily winning fights. So let's get into that interview right now with Billy McFarland. All right, my guest this week is comedian Billy McFarland.
Hey there.
Billy has been a comic since I started. He's one of my favorite people to talk to because he's always just positive personality. He grew up playing basketball. He was a college basketball player at Wachita Baptist University.
Oklahoma Christian,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The other conservative Christian basketball
school. Right, yes, exactly.
They were the
Jesus had to choose, he would have been us.
You're the Washington Generals of the NCAA.
We are. Thank you.
That just makes me think of the SNL skit where they had Michael Jordan on there. And they had like the bounce pass to each other, like around the center of the court. Just
back and forth.
I was like, yeah, that's... So how did you find basketball at such an early age? Like, how did you, I guess, fall in love with the sport of basketball?
Well, you know, I'm an old man, so I was born in 1970, so I was always playing outside, and I didn't have many friends. Basketball is like the only sport you can play without having to have a friend. You know, like I remember my dad came home, he wanted to throw the football with me, and the only way I could throw a football to myself was to like just kind of throw it up with my, like a hook shot and then run. And I remember my dad's like, throw the football to me, and I'm trying to throw the ball to him. He's like, what the hell are you doing, son? So I was like, okay, I'm not playing football anymore. But we built a basketball in my front driveway. And I just shot baskets from the time I got home or the time I woke up until the time they made me come in. Mm-hmm. And the neighborhood kids would come down and play. And I always made sure I was better than everyone in that neighborhood, which that was not much competition. But yeah, that's how I found it. I just played it nonstop since as soon as I could.
I will say it is like a neighborhood, like attention grabber. Like when you put the hoop up, like all the kids back in those days, it was like, oh, we don't have to go to a playground area, you know, a mile away. There's somebody that has one of these hoop things in our neighborhood.
Yeah. You come home from from church or from going out to eat with the family. There's kids already playing ball in your front yard or whatever. Yeah. So hey, instant fun or whatever. Yeah,
the awkwardness of pulling in and seeing kids just shooting on your hoop. And
yeah. Oh, hi, stranger. Yep. And
then, all fun. Then the casual, can we play? And then, but yeah, that's a great way. And I don't know if you made friends from that or just more enemies of just people.
What really stunk is I still didn't get any better. I was still awful. Like when I finally got to school around organized basketball, I was the worst. And I thought, oh man, I was the best on the block, and it didn't matter. I was awful. And I made a lot of friends though, because when I got to the real team, they could beat me. So yeah, it's easy to like a guy that you're better than. Yeah. So,
you were like their Rudy, like they just rooted for you to just make a basket.
Yes, for real. This is a true story. We recorded our games in seventh grade, and we'd have to, like, you know, watch them at the next day or whatever. And it was the coach, the team, two fans, and then me. And then once I remember I kind of paid attention, I looked up, and it was halftime, and the whole team was already in the locker room, so I had to run in. And
So
found out what was going on, but
so were the two fans in the stands like in a rotation before you? Like they
yeah,
were.
Yeah, the coach was like, "You need to sit here just in case these other people foul out, and I don't want him to play." And it was pretty easy.
That does remind me of John Mulaney's bit about the free throw.
Where yeah,
he's like terrible at basketball. He's like, "Oh no, you get free throws."
Yeah, that was my nightmare.
And he's like, "I shot and I missed the earth."
Oh,
because that's the thing about basketball is people can sit there and make shot after shot with no pressure, and that's the thing that basketball has is just this the ability to be able to perform when everybody's watching you is another level. It's like even in the NBA players, you can see people struggle to make shots.
Right. So it's in my freshman year of high school, we had some stupid thing. We're like, "Hey, all 600 of us, let's go down to this freshman basketball game and give a big boost to the team." So we all run down there and this kid that's never played before gets put in.
Mm-hmm.
And, He's looking around at all of us because they didn't know we're all coming. Mm-hmm. And he gets the rebound, goes up, gets fouled, and puts the shot back in, except he put it in the wrong goal. So the basket counted for the other team. And then he has to go down to this end and shoot a free throw. And then he missed that also. And I thought, we never should have come down here because 600 people never would have seen this if we didn't come down to watch it.
Yeah. That's... So how did you get good enough to actually, I guess, do collegiate basketball? Like, what was your secret to, I guess, even cracking that level? Because that's still, if you think about the attrition, because you start with junior high basketball and it's like half of the student body's playing, then you get to high school and those kids get weeded out and it's just your high school, then you're competing against other high school elites, basically, and that made up.
You're right. It's like the only one or two high schoolers go to any college level to play it. And then you're from that on, you're right. And I was not good when I got to my freshman year of college. I think it's because I got around better competition. Honestly, I was getting to play around people that really could play.
Mm-hmm.
And I could stay out till 11:15 playing basketball.
Yeah.
Oklahoma Christian had a curfew and I didn't know that was awesome. I had to be home by dark all the time. So it was just an addiction, basically. I just played nonstop, like just how comedy is.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's what basketball was. It was my life. And so by the end of my freshman year, I started dunking. And then throughout my second year, I was actually getting good enough where they asked me to come play with the team, with the recruits. And it was during my third year, they're like, "Why don't you talk to coach about walking on the team?" And I was like, nah. And then my last year, and now he said, "No, you'll never play, but you'll put you last on the bench,"
mm-hmm.
which was great, considering I never played high school ball.
Yeah. I mean,
I'll take it.
Yeah. That's a badge of honor. People don't realize like how good, even at the NBA level, the end of the bench players can be. I was like, there's a reason that superstars are superstars. It's because they had the scrimmage against people that didn't have that opportunity that will fight, claw, and basically, push the legal bounds of sport to do things
right.
Like NBA level Draymond Green's like that. Like, is he, gifted anything other than just basically testing the referee's like ability to blow the whistle at every single play? Cause you can't as like at some point as a ref, you have to let them play. And it's a crazy like theory, because it's like you could literally in 5 minutes be done with the game. Like they could foul you out if they really wanted to, but you just develop that reputation and it becomes something that the refs give you.
Yeah, he knows how to dance that line, better than anyone since Rodman.
Yeah, and it's a thing like that, and I say that with the second string on a college basketball team. You watch those starters, like they revere those guys because practice is a war. I mean, there's no winners and losers in practice. It's just everybody just goes into a locker room and just collapses because you're just You're both pushing yourself to the physical and mental limits of what you guys can take. And that's right. That's what I like about sports is it shows you where your limits are and that you can get past them. That they're only limits that you've set on yourself. Like you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I felt when I blew my knee out, that's when I stopped getting better. Like I could start, I was jumping really well and everything, but I knew I'd reached about my potential as good as I could get, quite honestly. And the other guys around me, they were still better. Like, that guy that was a 2-time All-American, that was my roommate, and he was great. But at the end of every practice, or not every practice, but every few practices, they always said, "Hey man, good job." Or we all gave equal effort.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, every now and then you come across, I got to play with a couple guys that went to the NBA. And when you talk about a man among boys, I thought I was good. And then this guy, he's some guy from University of Central Oklahoma. He dunked on us 4 times in a row. And the last two were oops. And the last one, I swear, 4 of us jumped at the same time and he got all of us. And he was played in the league for Charlotte for 2 years. And he was had a couple of highlights on top 10 for Sports Center. But oh, it's stupid to watch how good this guy was.
Yeah.
And it's like you say those are top 10. You should have seen when he took all 5 of us to the rack. And
who?
I said you should have been like, you see the ESPN top play. You're like, man, you should have seen him back when he took all 5 of my lineup.
That was a top 10 play. Look, that game right there. They just look silly.
So when did you find comedy?
I found comedy I was, without being cocky, I was always like funny around my friends, of course. Mm-hmm. And in college, we had a masquerade banquet, whatever, for my fraternity. We had social service clubs, not fraternities, but same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so we had booked a comedian, and she was known, her headline was, she was one of the dirty women of comedy. And so she gets there, and right before we're about to give the mic to her, the guy says, "No, we're from Oklahoma Christian, so you have to be clean." And you saw her face just drop. So, can you imagine? Can you imagine, doing that to, Brad LaCour or whatever? Say, "Hey, I need you to be completely squeaky clean the whole way through and don't say anything weird." And it's like, you're like, what?
But to be fair, we've done those gigs where it's like you walk in the door. Oh, by the way, you got to be clean. As an aside, like, oh, that's that.
They brought their 5-year-olds, all of them. So yeah,
let me just go ahead and put my filter on. And
so she does like 5-10 minutes of material, but she's quickly into crowd work. And so she kind of gets near me and we start a little bit of crowd work. And I remember one of my friends had a ying, one of those like the yin yang little things. Mm-hmm. Things. Yeah. And so she's like, "Oh, Oklahoma Christian lets you have these yin yangs." I was like, "Yeah, you're going to get kicked out if you get that close to his yin yang or whatever." And like, ah, ha, ha. So she came over afterwards and she goes, "We have open mics in Oklahoma City. You should maybe come down and try it." And I was like, "Oh, no, I'm going to be a choir director." But it was in the back of my head. Comedy, that sounded kind of funny. Well, then I work in Branson, Missouri for a summer at Ray Stevens Theater, just doing popcorn. But I found a gig out there. And during the off times, I found his band between shows, and we would kind of hang out and talk, and I would make his band laugh. Well, his bass player said, "Billy, if you want to come up next year and for the summer and you get 30 minutes of material, I'll get you a job as a comedian here on the strip in Branson." And that's a great offer. Mm-hmm. And what I said to him when I was 22 years old? I said, "Oh, no, no, I'm going to be a choir director." And I went back to Oklahoma Christian. But it always stuck in my head. Mm-hmm. And so when I finally moved to Dallas, I was married. I was living in Dallas. And I was watching Premium Blend. Remember that show on Comedy Central? There felt like 3 comics. And I remember one guy in particular. And I remember I wasn't thinking, I'm funnier than this guy. But I remember thinking, I can do just as good as this guy. Because I was working in a restaurant, and you have to have these like pre-shift meals, pre-shift meetings, alley rallies.
Yeah.
And I would always do a bit or two during those things. So I was already kind of open micing a little bit without even knowing it. And so I started calling around, and the only place I knew was the improv. So I called the improv. I was like, "Hey, when you guys have an open mic, can I be on it?" And they said, well, call us at 5 o'clock Tuesday. I'll let you know. So I called 5 o'clock Tuesday and they said, oh, sorry, the list is full. Call back next Tuesday. So I called the next Tuesday. Oh, sorry, the list is full. Call back next Tuesday. This happened like 5 weeks in a row. So finally I said, I just want to know where can I go to try this once? And they gave me Linda's number at Backdoor Comedy Club. Mm-hmm. And so I called there and Jan answered and Backdoor Comedy. And I said, yeah, I want to do comedy there. And she's like, all right, 2 minutes of material or 3 minutes of material, squeaky clean, nothing that comes out of a hole of your body, no cursing, all this and stuff. And I remember I hung up and she goes, all right, we'll see you in 2 weeks. And I hung up and I thought, well, I now have to write 3 minutes of material because I didn't know you went up and had written jokes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote my 3 minutes and I timed it. It was like 258, 301, 259, 301. And, I went up and, I did well, actually. When I came off stage, Linda, she's like, oh, get him. And Jan called me over. And by the way, this is back when it was, off Buckner at Shadyside Cafe. And, so Jan calls me over and she's like, hey, you did really good. I'm like, oh, thank you. And she goes, hey, on Tuesday and Wednesday, we're going to have PBS come out and film a special for local PBS. We want you to come out and do one of those things for me. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so she goes, all right, well, let's get your name and number. So I'm writing down my name and number. And she goes, all right, well, how long have you been doing comedy? And I said, that was my first set. And she put her pen down. She goes, well, then you did really good. And then I came back on that Tuesday and I bombed in front of a TV camera. I bombed it because I talked way too far from the microphone. So you couldn't hear me for the whole thing. But that's how I found comedy. And just, I thought dunking a basketball was the greatest thing I'd ever would feel in my life. Mm-hmm. until I walked off that stage the first time. Cause when you hear laughs that first time, you know, that rush was better than anything I'd ever felt.
And that's what I tell people. That's what I always chase is that I chase the feeling of my first time doing it, but with the knowledge of doing it now, like having the knowledge and experience that I have now. And it's just like, if I could just find a way to have that innocent feeling again with all the knowledge and know-how. And that's what kind of feeds you. It's like it drives you, but at the same time, like it's never enough because it doesn't feel as good as that first time. But
if I could build a time machine for half my body,
yeah,
and just, you know, and meld them together, you know.
Yeah, because I was like, that's the goal. That's like, that's the feeling I'm chasing, is I want first time feelings with 16 years now of comedy experience, you know, under my belt, to just, you know, to be able to deliver, okay, this is, push this button here and magic. And, you know,
right. Or the first time you're doing open mics and dealing with crowds that don't like you, and now knowing how to deal with them or how to not care, you know, how to drive home from a terrible night and not care.
How to be okay
as
with
much.
It.
You're right. Yeah. How to deal with the terrible feelings that comes along. I'm not asking for much.
Yeah.
I'm just asking for how to cope.
Yeah. And it's just getting an understanding that it's nothing you did, because it's, you have, when you start out, you have these simple, like, naivete things of, like, I did something wrong. This is all my fault. I ruined the night for everybody. I walked through. Like, when you walk the room for the first time, like, just the sheer horror of just seeing, like, seven people just
three
get
people,
up.
Yeah, just three tables, just get up and just leave. Maybe they have to get up early tomorrow. Maybe they're...
And you're like, one more. Yeah. And then you see everybody leave, and then you just have to, you just get off stage, and the next, everybody's glaring at you as they're about to go up.
that's not a good feeling.
And so we're like, so how long have you been doing? So that, since Shadyside, because that's before me, I started in 2006. So I started when they were on Ross. So I got, my first time was on Ross Avenue location.
Nice. I loved that location, by the way. I love that location. I started about 3 months after Paul. I know that because he came up to me after a couple open mics and, you know, was very encouraging to me and it would tell me a lot about comedy and everything. So I was really grateful for him and stuff. So what is that, around 2001?
Yeah. That's when Paul started, like, right as, I guess, the almost like around the 9/11 stuff happened. So,
okay. Yeah. So I remember I was 30 years old and I told myself I was going to try it before I turned 31.
Okay.
Was my goal.
So you've always been funny and just the lady coming to you and just doing a show for a Christian school is
that was the first click. Cause I honestly, I know this sounds weird. I thought comedians just is like a fairy, just all of a sudden just poof, here comes a comedian on television. Like I didn't know it was a real job. I was so naive to so many things. I never thought about it.
Yeah.
And once it became an actuality of, no, you can really do this. I was like, wow. It was her was my realization that there was an ability. And then up 3 months later, I went to a comedy club with a girl I was dating. And the first comic on stage was so terrible that I do remember thinking, well, if I ever decide to do this, I know I'll be better than that guy. So that was... That was consolation I had.
Yeah. I would say I knew it was a job, but I just didn't know how to start is how I saw people. Like I've watched comedy since I was like a little kid. Like you grew up around my era. So there used to be B-movies on weekends. So I would, because I didn't have a lot of social circle in middle school and stuff in high school, I would have a weekend nightly all night watching routine. But would start with A&E's and Evening at the Improv, and then it would jump to another comedy show. Then maybe there was like a late night wrestling. And then around 1 a.m. or so, USA would have Up All Night, which Friday night would be Ron DeShear, and Saturday night would be Gilbert Gottfried, and it would be a terribly bad movie. Like that's one thing about this modern movie thing is like there's no B movies anymore where it's just like you knew they were going to be bad and they were just so fun to watch. It was just fun to watch the awful. And so that's basically what they would do. It was kind of like what Elvira would do with the, you know, the Mystery Science Theater, and they would just have these terrible B movies and it would be so fascinating to me. And I just grew up around comedy, but I never knew, like, okay, well, how did somebody get in? Because we live in Texas. It's not really in New York and L.A. I'm sure there are you from an earlier age, you know how to get into stand up. Here, you're not really you don't even know there is stand up as much as there is.
Yeah. It just never crossed my mind.
And you even still, like, to doing it 16 years, I'll still go to Hyenas or somewhere and people will be like, this is my first time ever at a comedy club. And I'm like, but we've been here. Randy has been here since 2001, even. So it's like we've had comedy in this, a steady comedy club in this scene since 1980 something. Bill Engvall started here.
Yeah.
How do you guys not know about stand-up comedy?
It's amazing how big this city is and how other people can get consumed in their own world. It never occurs to them. It just never occurs to him. And, you know, it never occurred to me until that lady came up that it would even existed in Oklahoma City.
Yeah. So do you do comedy in Oklahoma? Have you, like, done the Looney Bins or anything like that? Or you?
Man, I've opened the Looney Bins years ago and everything. And then I was trying to get up to feature, but I wasn't good enough to feature at that time for sure. And so when they wouldn't feature me, of course, being a comic, I'm like, well, then I'm not going to go there and open unless they're not going to feature me. And so that has worked out well in my career, as you can see, with the no gig.
To me, I'm always like, comedy's always be there. Like, I'll tell people, it's like, life comes first. You know, there are people that have, you know, relationships or family or kids that they, and I'm like, that comes first. That comedy is not going to just disappear from the state of Texas in a year if you don't come out here. You'll have to work your way back up like everybody else, of course, but it's still going to be here in some capacity. So don't freak out like if you like, oh my gosh, my kids need me. Well, yes, then by all means, please take that time off and don't worry about it. Like, Arredondo's doing that right now. He's, you know, hasn't been in the scene for well over a year, And, you know, just, I'm like, it'll all come back. Like, it's,
yeah,
it's doesn't mean, you know, just because you tried it and you can't do it now, doesn't mean that it's not meant to be.
It doesn't mean you still can't be writing some as well. It doesn't mean you can't be, recording some things here and there. You can do what you can do, but yeah, life's got to come first, you know?
And so also with comedy, you also got to manage the Hyenas Comedy Club. You were, I think, the second or third GM in Hyenas.
The second one. The second GM at Dallas, yeah. Hyenas.
It's a personal business, is what I tell people about comedy. It's like, if you think you can separate yourself from it, good luck. Because I don't...
Right.
You know, I feel like I'm one of the strongest at being able to do that, because I can see both sides of the coin. But even I will let my, you know, emotions out of the bag every once in a while. And
yeah.
I'm like, if you don't think, you know, this is emotion, isn't emotional for everybody, it is. It's like, it's all ego. Everybody's ego. It's, you know, it's the club's ego. It's the comic's ego. It's the staff. And I'm like, it's a lot to process if you're not paying attention. If you're not careful, you can burn bridges really easy by just, you know, speaking before you really consider, because you can say things in a green room that could then get you booked, unbooked, banned, or fired, or and it's just, I mean, you've been in it as much as I have. You've seen, and you've been that person too. Like, you know, that's watched comics make mistakes that have, you know, the bookers like, get out, you know, and just like, you're done, you know.
Yes.
And it's like, why would you, you know, and it's so many of it's common sense. Like, some of it to me, I'm just blown away. Like, and so I've learned that. And like, as someone that's now kind of like a helping hand to the club and just does, you know, does kind of the getting them ready to work as a comic, I kind of tell them that stuff. I'm like, impressions matter. I was like, if you make a bad impression, you know how hard that is to get rid of. Like, as much as, you know, I understand, like, if you make a bad impression, sometimes it's just not something you can recover from for a while, because that's all they see is the bad impression.
Right. I mean, you might be hilarious, mm-hmm. but how are you going to get into a club and work and show everyone else you're hilarious if you're a jerk to the owners, if you don't understand how the business part works? That's why it's called show business.
Understand that it is a business and it's not anything mm-hmm. personal. Why people, so many comics are just like, man, I don't know why they don't like me. I was like, that's not about liking or not.
Yeah, they don't even think about you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's what blows me away. And I bring that up because this is a podcast about fears. And so because you're a GM, like, that's some of the, and as a comic anyways, like, it's a hard thing. And I also am afraid of what you're afraid of, which is confrontation. And, you know,
oh, yeah.
And it's something, even as a comic, that just happens. Like, you don't mean to be confrontational, but sometimes people will say something either about your jokes or, you know, or some set you did that you thought you did well, and they'll be like, man, Billy just sucked. And it's like, you just said, well, excuse me, you know, like it
right. Yeah.
So how did this fear start for you, as like being afraid of confrontation? Is it just from growing up in Bible Belt, you know, Oklahoma?
Yeah, we're bored about Judgment Day. So let's see, you know.
Also, I would say some of it comes from your mom, because your mom is like the sweetest, but, you know, just kind of, you know, never, you never like think about your mom as a confrontational person. That's something I feel like comes.
No, she was super sweet. Now, yeah, I got spanked. Is that the word you talk? I got lots of spankings a lot growing up, but I was a bad kid. I understand. I was not good. My mom never said I was a bad kid. My mom said I was busy, which is true. And
busy being bad.
And I
sorry, full schedule today of just
at the end of our block where I grew up, we had a thing. It was like a full city block wide. It was a ditch, and it was mm-hmm. about 6 to 7, 8 feet deep, pretty much all the way around. And they eventually, in the 80s or late 70s or whatever, they turned it into a BMX bicycle track. Like, that's how big and how deep this thing
so
was.
Fun.
Yeah. And so we just called it the ditch, and that gives no justice. It was big. So when I was like 4 years old, it rained. It rained hard. And I somehow got out of the house, and I got a sand bucket, and I walked down to that ditch. And frogs, baby frogs, were coming out of this ditch like crazy. And I was picking them up and putting them in this bucket. And the foot, it's about 2 feet deep of water at the bottom of this ditch. And a three-year-old, I never would have gotten out of that thing. And all I remember, all of a sudden, I felt my mom grab my arm, and I looked up at her, and I was like, "Flogs, Mama, flogs!" And she dumped those frogs, and they jumped, went every direction. I had about 300 of them, and she spanked me the whole way home. I was like a helicopter running in circles the whole way back to that house. Now that one I deserved, you know, because I could have been killed. You know, I get that one, but that wasn't no confrontation. I don't know. I grew up in South Texas. It was weird. It's like 90% Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know, it's like I said, I was just born and raised in that environment. So I didn't think nothing of it. That's just how it was for me. But I remember when I was in junior high, my sister was in high school. And every now and then she would come home and she would say, "Oh, there was a fight in the cafeteria." But she was every day, she was like, "Oh, there's a gang fight today," or "There's a gang fight outside," or mm-hmm. "There's a gang fight at the football game." And me being just so frail and innocent and and just always reading the Bible, it felt like, or something, I thought, "Oh, a gang fight? That sounds awful." And then we moved to Laredo, Texas, my freshman year. And Laredo, Texas was a tough town. I didn't know a single person. And like my first day of school, I saw like four dudes chasing one of these football players across the campus, like across this huge field. Mm-hmm. And they tripped him. And when they tripped, he fell and rolled. And six dudes just jumped on top of him and started beating the crap out of him. And I thought, I better watch my P's and Q's here in Laredo.
You can't even win on the football team. Like,
that guy was strong and fast, and they got him. Like, I wasn't going to run. So I had a fear right away in mm-hmm. high school of, I don't want that to be me.
Yeah.
Because at least he had other friends come and help him after they jumped on him. Other friends came in, you know, and I didn't know a single person. So they just would have done it till I died or something. So I guess that's what it was, seeing that. Okay. I didn't want it hurt.
Yeah, it's emotions that you're not used to.
Yes.
Like the anxiety and just constant fear of that. Like, and also, you know, people can sense that too. Like something's going on. Mm-hmm. Like panic breeds panic.
Right. That's true.
And so you were talking about, like, when did you get into your first fight? Like, because I thought you got that at Hyenas is what I thought.
That was the first time I landed a punch.
Okay. Okay. So we'll get to that second. So what was your first fight?
My first fight was, I was a junior in high school and he was a sophomore. He was on the swim team. And we were in class, and him and another dude were playing some game on like a sheet of paper and pencil, or I don't know what. And I kept messing with him, and he was getting angrier with me. And he said, "You do it one more time and I'm going to beat you up." And I thought, well, who beats somebody up over a sheet of paper and a pencil or whatever? So I, of course, did it one more time. And well, every class for the rest of the day, he was waiting right outside that door. Like, I don't know how he got there, but he was there every class. And the whole time we'd walk, he'd be saying, "You ready to fight? You ready to fight?" and stuff. So Scott Winters was his name. And I said, I remember it was on a Friday. And I said, "Scott, if you want your fight, you got your fight. Monday after school, behind the swimming pool," is like around, like, well, it was like a city park and a swimming pool, a parking lot, and a basketball goal in a big field. And then my house was like around the corner, like a block away.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, "We'll meet after school there." And he's like, "All right." And so I went home, and it rained all weekend. It rained all weekend.
Even
hard.
God didn't want to see you fight.
Yeah, God's like, please, let's rain this out. Please, it's rain delayed. And so here comes Monday, and it's after school, and mutual friends, like there's two of the guys, Billy Brennick and someone else, they came, they picked me up in a van, and while they're driving me back to this parking lot where we're going to fight, they tell me, like, all right, well, Scott's really excited about the fight. And I did not want to hear that. I did not like the idea that someone was excited about beating the crap out of me, because I was not excited about getting beaten up. So Vegas odds were not good in my favor here. So they said, what he's going to do is he's going to start coming at you, and he's going to say, what the fuck, what the fuck, what the fuck? And he said, when he gets close enough, he's going to punch you. And I thought, all right, well, I now have a scouting tip. So I've got this fight won. And so we get out there, and sure, he takes off his shirt, and I'm like, ah, he has kind of muscle. He has like muscle definition as a sophomore because of that swim team thing. I was like, he even looks tougher than me now. And I kept on my, my Daffy Duck shirt or something. I don't know what I was wearing, but it was not fun. It was not tough. And just like they said, what the fuck? What the fuck? What the fuck? And I thought, okay, I've got longer arms than him, so I just got to punch him first. And right when I think he's close enough, I throw three hard, fast punches, and all three land this far from his nose. All three. And he does one of these things, and then he starts walking at me again. Well, those three punches were all I had. And I remember I was like, I don't want to fight, Scott. I don't want to fight anymore. I've showed you my lightning quick speed, and that's enough, I think. And so I started backing up. And remember, it rained all weekend, so this field is like muddy and standing water in some places, real thick mud. So I'm backing up the entire way, and he's kind of like trying to follow me. He's waiting for me to slip so he can jump on me. And I never fell down. And then I got to where the street was, and I said, Scott, I am going to turn around and I'm going to walk home now, and I'm not going to fight you. And I turned around and I ran. I told him I was going to walk, but that was a lie. I did it. And I ran home. And then him and his friends drove around. They knocked on my door for a few minutes and I didn't answer. So I thought, problem solved. So my mom told a guy from our church about what happened. And, this is the guy that already run over my foot and broken my foot. So I really didn't really trust this guy already, but he was the best we had. That's who Jesus sent me. So apparently, he sits me down, and he was like country, like old time, Paul, John Wayne kind of country. And, he was like, all right, Bill, tell you what, this kid, he wants to fight you. So, tell him you're going to meet up, you're going to fight him, and I'm going to be there. And in my head, I'm like, oh, good. He'll keep me from getting beaten up, or maybe he'll beat the kid up for him. He goes, no, I'll just be there to watch, and I'll just say, go get him. And if you get beat up, you get beat up, but I'll be there to support you. And I thought, well, then I still don't want to meet this kid for this fight if you're coming along to just watch. So I said, oh, I don't want to fight the kid. So he's like, all right. And went to school, and Scott never bothered me anymore for some reason, but I did watch my back around him if we were ever close proximity. So yeah, that was my first fight, my first punches thrown.
Did Scott ever tell you what happened after? Did you ever like find Scott and Scott Winter and settle this out? Because
we've never spoken again. I do not remember us ever speaking again.
Okay. He would have been a hell of a comic. Like, I feel like he's like the comedian that's like, hey, I'm here. I'm ready. I'm available if you need me.
Yeah.
You need a fight. I'm available. I'm booked. I'm looking.
You guys got an open mic fight? Yeah. I can do that.
And so then we get to the one, like a couple. You got into a couple of scraps at.
I did. And I'm not a fighter. Like, I'm not violent. I'm not fight. But, that job would bring it out of you because it's the people that come to comedy clubs, especially those late shows, there's a lot of ones that are drinking. Mm-hmm. And once you get drunk people out there, man, you don't know what's going to happen. So yeah, that just breeds craziness. So the first one, the most infamous fight, I would say, the one that's given me my famous nickname, I was at Hyenas Dallas managing. I had three door guys. One was a former cop in New York. One, I think, wanted to be a cop, and one was just a pretty tough guy. I don't even know who the headliner was, but a couple walked out. Some girl walked out, and her boyfriend went outside, and they fought. And while they were fighting, she broke up with him. And so after she broke up with him, she decided to get away from him by going back into the showroom. And so here he comes, and he's like, "You're not gonna walk away from me." And so we're not gonna let that walk into the showroom in a comedy show. So we saw one of my door guys stops him. "Hey, buddy, let's talk about it." And so while two of them are trying to talk to him, he kind of goes to headbutt one of them or something. And so now here comes the third one. So we got three guys over there, and I'm on the other side by the bartender. I think it's Mercedes, and I can't remember who the comic was. And so I'm like, well, now that I got my door guys involved, I'll go over because the guy can't beat me up. There's three door guys. So I go over and I'm like, "Dude, we're going to have to kick you out. You're drunk. We're going to get your ticket." Well, then he goes to headbutt me. And I mean, he grazed me. He barely hit, but he barely touched me. And so, of course, right away, the three dudes are like, "That's it. You're out of here." And they start dragging him out towards the front door. Well, I decide that I am offended enough by him trying to headbutt me that I am going to punch him. And I've got years of anger bottled up from Scott Winters waiting to catch one of these things. So I position myself around and I swing as hard as I can and I catch him right on the chin. And I'll admit, I was really proud of that punch. And they drag him out the rest of the way. And I cocky walk back on over and I'm like, "You guys, y'all see me punch that guy?" And they're like, "Yeah, we did. And we're going to nickname you Charmin Fists from now on."
Didn't you like hurt your hand on that too? Didn't you like?
No, didn't even hurt. Didn't even hurt. No people were hurt in the making of this fight. And so it's like Charmin Fist. They're like, "Yeah." I was like, "But I punched the guy." They're like, "Billy, this is how you punched him." And they said, I went like this. And followed through. And I thought, well, that can't be true. So by this time, the dark police had put him in cuffs and everything. Mm-hmm. So I run out there and take a look at him. And yeah, he didn't have a mark on his face. So that was my Charmin Fists moment there.
Yeah, I think my favorite fight is the girl that stole alcohol.
That, see now, this is called progression. My first fight didn't land a punch. Second fight, landed a punch, but didn't hurt anybody. But then here comes the graduation of Charmin Fists right here. This was my coup de grace. I will never fight again because I could never top this fight.
Yeah.
Ever. And I like how you preface it, but right now, the people listening, all they know is that it's a girl. So they think that I'm proud that I've knocked a girl like clean out or something, and that's not true.
Yeah.
So
Holt, stand by, people that are already forming judgments about where this is going.
Right, exactly. I was like, I need to clear this up immediately. So I was just telling this story like 3 days ago. So yeah, I was managing at Hyenas, and there was a comic up from San Antonio, and he had two other, a guy and girl with him, up there at the club. And they're just kind of introducing each other to other comics throughout the night, just, you know, just being people. And Liz was the bartender up front. And I was up front also. And I remember she came up and she said, "Billy, did you take two bottles out of the well?" And I look in the well and sure enough, there's two bottles. It's just completely empty. And I was like, "No." And she all of a sudden, she just has like a light bulb moment. And she goes, "There's a girl with a big trench coat that's been standing around. I bet she took it." And we look up and she's going through the window, walking out the door towards that movie theater. Yeah. And I just saw a glimpse of her in that trench coat. Mm-hmm. And right. So I'm like, "Oh my goodness, here we go." So I start going out after them. They had gotten on the elevator before I did. So when I get off the elevator, they're in the parking garage and I see them walking, and I see she's got the trench coat, a guy on this side, and a short Asian guy on this side with a bottle, walking and swinging the bottle while he's walking. And then like 6'3", 6'4" Hispanic dude, he's also walking, swinging the bottle. And so I remember I was like, I've got to get that alcohol back. I wasn't thinking about nothing else. And so I'm walking up on him behind him. I'm kind of jogging up on him. And I remember, I think I've got to take out one of these people. If I say, hey, give me that alcohol, and these two dudes say no, well, now it's going to be what, a fight between me and these two guys. So I've got to somehow take one of them out of the equation before we even start this brouhaha. And my thought was, I'm going to grab his arm and I'm going to yank it out of socket. I'm going to yank it as hard as I can. Maybe I can yank it out of socket and he won't want to fight, and I'll just have to deal with this big guy by myself. And so when I do, and of course it doesn't yank it out of socket, but it does make him turn around and stuff. And as soon as he turns around, I let go with my hand and came huge overhand and caught him right on the top of the head. And as soon as I did, he dropped. And then I grabbed his hair and pulled him up. And I was like, give me the bottle. And he lifts up. He's got the alcohol bottle. And I grabbed the alcohol bottle from him. And then I thought, I wonder where the other guy's at. And I look, he's put the bottle on the ground and he's running away. So with one punch, mm-hmm. two people, done.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the girl, she runs off also. And then so I got both bottles back. And went back up to the club, I remember, and when I turned the corner, all y'all saw me, and I held up the bottles of alcohol, and it was like, huge celebration.
So from my perspective, so I saw the whole thing because it was an open mic night.
Yeah.
And so it was an open mic, so Liz was there, and I think Liz did something, or she got pulled away for something, and the girl... I saw the girl like get up on the bar and like lean over the bar and grab and pull him out and then do that. And that's when I said, Liz, something's going, like she just was, I saw that she leaned over, but I didn't see her grab the bottles. And I'm like, and then they tried to get out. And then Liz is like, she took two wells. And I was like, I'll tell you who it was. It's that girl. And she like went and told you, and the rest is history, because it's like, holy shit, I've never seen someone this brazen before.
Right, exactly.
To take drinks out of a bar, in a crowded bar, like to be able to, try and do that. And she like hung around for a little bit to try not look suspicious.
Okay, that's right. I was wondering how could she have taken it, and then I still saw her just walking there. So she tried to hang out a tiny bit. So.
Yeah, she was on the stairs like talking, being flirty or whatever. But yeah, they had
gave her a number to some people too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, she wasn't bad looking, but she just like leaned.
No, she wasn't.
She like, she jumped on the bar and like leaned over and then pulled herself back out. And
wow.
And I was like, Liz, I think she took a bottle. And then Liz like, she took two. And I was like, no shit. And so then she went and got you. And then that's when.
So, yeah. And so I remember whoever that comic was in San Antonio, I called the San Antonio club and I told him what happened. And I don't know if anything ever came up for him, but I was hoping he never got to get on their stage again either.
Yeah. That was, so how do you, are you still like afraid of confrontation, or has the hyenas, like that time at Hyenas, made you more like less afraid of it just because you had to actually deal with it?
It's I believe my divorce helped me not be terrified of confrontation. Mm-hmm. I still don't like it. And then teaching defensive driving when I had did that for a super long time, because now it's not even an open mic where people that don't exactly want you to be there have mm-hmm. to listen to you for 9 minutes. Now it's people that absolutely do not want to be there, and they have to listen to you for 6 hours. And so that would bring out some real confrontation. And I've learned that taught me the most of how to deal with it.
See, to me, that's crazy to think that of all the things, defensive driving, that would be the workplace you learn confrontation. Just people just like saying, like, let me out of here. Just people trying to get out of doing defensive driving.
Or they just start just not paying attention, talking to their phones or whatever. Yeah.
Wow.
The best I heard, this guy said, he said, I shouldn't be here. He's like, and the other teachers, wasn't me, this and that. He's like, all right, well, we all feel like that, but here we go. No, I really shouldn't have to be here. And finally, after enough, he's like, listen, if you're going to have to leave, if you're not going to let me teach the class. And the guy said, well, I bet you won't step outside and tell me that. And it's at the spaghetti warehouse in 75. And so it was like a room. Then you step outside and it's the actual restaurant. And so he stepped outside. He told the guy was bigger. He's like, you're kicked out of here. And he said, then the guy picked me up, threw me over a booth into the second booth, and then was banging my head into the wall until management came and pulled him off of me. And then he ran off and stuff. And when this teacher, it was Terry Yates. I don't know if you know Terry Yates, but when Terry Yates told me that, I was like, well, that's a crazy story. But in the back of my head, I thought, I wonder if that's kind of made up. Well, then 2 weeks later, the manager of this restaurant comes over and tells me the exact same story, the exact same way. I was like, well, that's two people that may have exaggerated. Then the server comes over and tells me a few weeks later, well, like now years later, I'm teaching another class. And this person in the class is, you know, I was in a class once where a guy threw the dude over a booth and was banging his head in the wall. I'm like, Spaghetti Warehouse? They're like, yeah. And so whenever I heard those stories, I thought, all right, I never want that to happen to me. That's for sure.
So that's crazy. That's
always in the back of my mind. Yeah, I'll come across those crazies.
Jeez, like I would have never guessed like defensive driving because to me it's just such a beating. But I've only had to do it like two times, and I had to do it like video. Like the video wouldn't.
Well, yeah, and if you do it at home, I guess you can't really get in a fight at home.
Yeah, so, you just do it. But
yeah,
That, Billy, this has been one of the best episodes. Where can people find you on social media if they wanted to check you out? Have you got any shows coming up?
Shows coming up? No, just backdoor shows.
Okay.
I've been contacting Linda to get back up. Me and Seth actually watched the Celtics game, and he's like, man, Billy, you need to come to backdoor some more. So I'm coming to backdoor. You'll see me there.
Good.
That, I don't know where else I'll be yet. I'm waiting for people to call me.
All right, well. Where on social media can people find you if they were wanting
to? Of course, Facebook, Billy McFarland, Twitter, Billy McFarland. I'd say my Instagram, but I can't even remember what my thing is. I'm never ever on Instagram. Just Twitter, Billy McFarland. It's not the one that's just got out of prison. I get messages for people thinking that I'm that guy all the time. Some DJ in Denver, she started talking crap to me. And I said, hey, fly me out for $5,000. I'll tell you everything. I'll give you an exclusive interview. And then she never responded. So
there's a Billy McFarland that just got out of prison. Like, how long has he been out of prison now that the people still message you?
Like, he's only been out of prison a month. But he was the guy that did that fire festival.
Okay.
So he was in the news for a while.
Okay, well, definitely we'll do that. You got to get on Instagram, Billy. You got to do some reels and stuff.
I'll get on the gram.
Have you never done a TikTok or a reel? I feel like that would just be up your alley. Like it would be.
I'm you know what I mean? That's one of my fears is TikTok. I'm terrified of how to work those things. I don't know.
It's a short form video.
Somebody young in my life and not in a weird way.
Okay. Well, you can find that. Well, I can't wait to see you at Backdoor because that'll be great. More fun for me. Thanks again for doing this, Billy.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, man. This was a lot of fun.
So that was Billy. Billy's got a ton of fun stories. He does some amazing work on stage as well. Some of his stories are extremely hilarious. So check out Billy McFarland. I believe he has some shows coming up at Hyenas here soon, so check him out, as well as Backdoor Comedy Club. We have some fantastic shows there on the weekends. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. 5 stars would be fantastic. Thanks again for listening to the Sum of All Fears podcast. We are rocketing towards 100 episodes. I actually interviewed episode 98. Earlier this afternoon, and so that one's in the can. I'll have more interviews coming up as soon as I possibly can. Again, I can't thank you guys enough. We're almost at 100. I just did a week with Mike Palasak, amazingly fun comic and dad out of the Los Angeles area. We had a great time, great weekend of work. I also worked with CJ Starr. It was an amazing show. So I hosted CJ Middled and then Mike Palasak headline. So hopefully we'll get to work with him again when he comes through again in the year. And that was a fun time. Also, I got the recording of my album. I still haven't listened to it because I'm still a little nervous, but I will get to that this week and start the preparations for getting that to be. I'm going to try and release it on my 16-year comedy anniversary. So thanks again for listening to the Sum of All Fears podcast. Have a wonderful week. And now some thank yous for the folks that make this show possible. Thanks to Barry Whitewater for my art and graphics. You can follow him on Instagram at bwhite2o. Get it? H2O, like water. You can also follow him on Facebook. Music. A huge thank you to Gunnar Olson for the wonderful music provided for this podcast. You can follow him on Instagram at gunbuns, that's G-U-N-B-U-N-S, as well as his website, gunnarolson.net. Check out some of the samples that he has recorded. They're amazing. He's an amazing percussionist. If you want to follow the show, we've got a Facebook group, Some of All Fears, Instagram, Twitter. You can find us at Some Fear Fans. If you have some feedback for the show, email me at somefearfans, S-O-M-E-F-E-A-R-F-A-N-S, at gmail.com. I'll be happy to take those into consideration. Also, if you'd like to be a guest, email me at somefearfans@gmail.com. We can try to iron out some details and get that settled in. You know, give us some feedback if on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, leave a review. It makes the show bigger, and it's not going anywhere. I'm going to record as many shows as I possibly can. If you want to follow me on social media, I am at Ryan Perio. It's R-Y-A-N-P-E-R-R-I-O on all social media platforms. You can follow me there, and you can check me out at ryanperio.com, my website. I'll try to list upcoming shows there as well. It's been kind of spotty because as soon as I set it up, that's when the pandemic happened. And everything's kind of just in a holding pattern. Thanks again for listening to the Sum of All Fears podcast. Next week, we'll have another guest with another fear. Thanks for listening.